Welcome again to Mormonland, a podcast produced by the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm managing editor Dave Noyce, along with the Tribune's senior religion reporter, Peggy Fletcher Stack. Hi, Peggy.
Hi.
Welcome. Joining us today is Lori Lee Hall, a distinguished architect who designed Mormon temples and served as an LDS bishop and stake president. She was excommunicated this past summer from the faith after coming out as a transgender woman. Lori, welcome. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be here.
Thank you. We're so glad to have you here. Well, Lori, your life has been quite the journey, spiritually and personally. When did you first notice your feelings of gender dysphoria or confusion?
And not being able to express what it was, but certainly looking back and understanding that I felt a gender incongruence as early as age 5. I can remember being taught how to use the toilet like a little boy should, and I thought, this is completely wrong. I don't need to be any different from the girls in my family. And, you know, it just that from that earliest memory, it became aware to me that they're telling me I'm male, but I really, that doesn't compute for me. But I didn't have the vocabulary to express it to anyone.
Mm-hmm. And as you grew up, more realization came?
Yeah, or? It was certainly very prominent in my mind and my heart throughout my teenage years. And by the time I got into my late teens and, you know, preparing for college and so forth, it became totally apparent to me that my body had rebelled and wasn't going to line up with my identity. And I felt the only safe and appropriate thing to do, this is in the late 1970s, I didn't know anything about transgender persons or anything of that sort. I took the only course that I felt was possible and safe and healthy, and I thought I was probably the only person that felt the way that I did at the time, and I buried that. I buried my identity and tried to go on and live a successful life as the male person everyone had socialized and taught me to be.
So where was this, and how did you find your way into the Mormon Church?
I grew up in Massachusetts, in rural Massachusetts, in the 60s and 70s, and in 1979, I went to Rensselaer Polytechnic to begin my studies in architecture, and I was introduced to the church through members of the church that were in my School of Architecture class, and it resonated with me, and I also saw an opportunity to set my course towards this successful male life, you know, of being in a priesthood quorum and, you know, doing all these things that looked like good Latter-day Saint men do. And I just moved forward with that. I was baptized and served a mission in Argentina and returned from that mission and had the opportunity to marry in the temple 32 years ago. And all of those things, you know, that we're supposed to do that deep in my heart, I really hoped would cure me of those gender feelings, but they never went away.
So did you joined the LDS Church because you thought it would help you be male? Or was there more to it?
There was certainly more to it. I developed a great and, you know, I think strong spiritual witness of the church at that time, something that I find is indelible in my life and I can't let go of. But I think from a, you know, from a spiritual aspect, I'm truly a convert. I was converted. But from a social aspect, I think I discovered socially the things that I felt I needed as underpinnings to be a successful male.
So you went on a mission. You married in a Mormon temple. You had children.
Mm-hmm.
You served in influential church positions, lay positions, but as a bishop and a stake president. All this while you were still wrestling with this gender identity issue.
At various times throughout my adult experience, it would be extraordinarily strong and difficult to grapple with, and it always felt shaming and guilty. You know, I felt those self-imposed feelings, if you will, of great guilt and shame for even thinking that way, let alone ever act out on it. It just was something that continued to be a part of my experience, but on and off. There were times where I could suppress it and get busy and not think of it. There were other times when it was very, very powerful. One of those times, we were still living in New York at the time. We'd been married about 10 years, and it just came crashing down on me that I could no longer be male. And I still didn't have the words to explain what I was feeling.
Did you tell your wife?
No, I couldn't. I couldn't figure out how to say that and what that would mean. I was far too frightened for what the consequences would be of admitting that. And so I saw a therapist. I left my job at an architectural practice. Couldn't explain what was going on. And all that they could offer to me is I needed a change of pace. And so after several months of kind of pulling myself back together, we moved to Utah and I started working for the church.
So when and how did you reach the decision that you could no longer live that kind of life and needed to be true to yourself in that identity?
So that initial time, which was over 20 years ago that I just described to you, mm-hmm. I didn't make the choice that I could do it at that time. I still thought I was the only person who felt this way. I had no connectivity with any support or any understanding of these issues. So I really felt like I was broken and that the only solution was to pick it up and try again. That lasted really until about 2011, about 6 years ago. And at that point, I found access to the understanding that I wasn't alone. In this situation, I found others even within the LDS Church who were experiencing these same feelings and somewhere in a journey of transition. I've been accused of doing enough research and reading that I talked myself into this. I don't feel that way. I feel very much like I finally found the resources necessary to become right and whole. And that process began six years ago, and ultimately came to, you know, fruition in its entirety a year ago when I retired from work for the church and began to live full-time, made all of the legal changes necessary to be accepted full-time as a woman. Can I interject? I've discovered two ways to frame my story, and our listeners need to make this choice for themselves. But in framing my story, one could say, here's a man who just kind of always wanted to be seen as a woman and all of that that goes along with it. But the other, more appropriate way to frame my story is here is a woman who for half a century was told to be male and struggled to find that voice that allowed her to finally begin to live for who she is. And if one can't see my story other than the first way, none of it's going to make sense. But if you can accept the reality that I'm offering, that framing my story the second way, that I am and always have been female, and that this struggle is about becoming myself, then you understand a lot better the beautiful truths that are real to me now that I'm expressing.
Does Mormonism, the theology or anything, offer you any comfort, or does it on this issue?
The Family Proclamation, of course, has been a hot topic lately, being used in many ways against LGBT. And maybe if they think about it, T. I studied that document very, very closely for quite some time before coming out to anyone to find that very piece that you're discussing, that, you know, is it there? Is there something in this faith that I feel so strongly about, that I have a strong spiritual witness about, that can help me understand better where I fit in the overall plan? And to me, and it's my personal interpretation, I'm not trying to get ahead of the leaders of the church, but to me, the statement in the proclamation that gender is eternal and is an essential characteristic of our premortal, mortal, and eternal identity absolutely rings true to me. My only witness, and it's a solemn witness, is that my eternal gender is female, and that there was an incongruity with regard to my physical body, which is not completely without precedent in the world, but that my eternal identity is indeed female. And if we, those of us who have the transgender experience, could help others to recognize that biological sex does not dictate eternal spiritual gender, there would be an opportunity for a lot more alignment in terms of the doctrines and the theology that you refer to. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm at, and I find peace in that. I find peace in the fact that I know that God knows who I am, and I know who He knows I am to be. And I find peace in that. And I find peace in the fact that although I don't know all the answers of how this is going to work out, and in terms of my family and marriage and so forth going forward, I have faith and confidence that I am part of the plan and not an anomaly, an exception perhaps, but not an anomaly.
So speaking of your wife and family, what was it like to tell them about it? Who did you tell first, and how did that go?
Yeah, it's important for me to not tell my family's story for them, so I'll be sparse in the things that I share, but I shared the experience. Once I came to grips with it myself and finally accepted myself, and I was 50 at the time, I knew that I had to tell my wife, and doing so began the past almost 6 years of heartbreaking experience. Telling our children, once we were both ready to share that, we told our children and their spouses, pair by pair, and mostly that went well, not entirely. Most of them are very loving and accepting of me, and I'm thrilled for that because not everyone has that with family. We're still close, although things change.
Did any of them sense this before?
No.
You talked to them?
As a matter of fact, I must have done a fabulous job of hiding it because it was a complete surprise and shock to most people that have known me as an adult. On the other hand, people who knew me as a teenager, my younger sister, my best friend growing up, once I told them, it clicked and made sense to them. And so I obviously wasn't as, I was more transparent perhaps as a teenager than I allowed myself to be as an adult. And so there's confirmation there in some ways that, yeah, people who knew me when can see this and it makes sense in their lives, what they remember of me.
So you eventually told your Mormon bishop.
Yes, there were a whole lot of other leaders that found out ahead of him.
Oh, really?
Okay. And that's another complex story. But yes, if we want to talk about my relationship with our former bishop, it was an interesting experience because he sensed spiritually that he needed to talk to me about this, but he didn't know really, he didn't have any prior knowledge of it. And so we became very close as we talked about my situation and my journey, and he chose to be an advocate for me and to attempt to make it doable for me to transition in my presentation within the ward and to feel safe and sense of belonging. That was really helpful to me. When it ultimately came time for me to come out, he worked with me to make that announcement possible.
How'd that happen?
We agreed that in a testimony meeting in July of last year, 2016, that he was conducting and he would bear his testimony and that I would be the first person to stand at the pulpit afterwards and announce my situation and testify of that which I felt. He did a marvelous job of kind of setting the table, if you will, with his words of affirmation and acceptance and inclusivity. And then I got there just in time to be the first speaker and shared my story and pled with, briefly, and pled with the congregation for compassion towards myself and my family, and for, if not their acceptance, at least their appreciation of the reality of what I was experiencing.
How did they respond?
There were many who embraced me, physically, literally embraced me at the end of the meeting, that were very kind and gentle in their comments and supportive. There were others who were very upset by what I had done and said, that it was something that occurred in a public church meeting. There was a lot of anger and aggression in some ways. I've mentioned to others that it's strange to think of that if you were to kind of plan out your process, where would be the best place to go through a major life crisis transformation experience like this? And one would think it would be amongst people that you've lived with and served with for years and years, who know you and your family and love you. And it actually turned out to be more difficult in many ways, because it was apparently so very difficult for others to see happen and to receive, who couldn't bring themselves to exercise any compassion. In some ways, I feel like I could have done this more successfully in a different place, a foreign place where no one knew me or knew of me or knew my past, which is counterintuitive to me.
Why were people angry with you?
I don't know, because the angry people wouldn't talk to me. But I could surmise from what people would tell me second and third hand that people who once relied on me as their priesthood leader and whom they had trust felt betrayed. And I can't explain that sense of betrayal. Others who didn't become angry with me actually saw and complimented and affirmed my courage, my integrity. You know, so I think it really depended a lot on where people were in relationship to being able to process this, whether it offended and hurt them, and it was difficult for them to process, or if they looked past their own biases to, you know, to see a person who was emerging as opposed to betraying.
So you had been a bishop in that congregation before?
Or was this different? Okay. I was the first bishop of that ward when it was formed, and I was the first president of that stake when it was formed.
So going back to those days when you were a bishop and a stake president, I know you're not going to betray any confidences, but you may have counseled some LGBT Mormons who came in for, you know, to talk with their situations. Did you ever do that? And how did that feel, knowing kind of what you were going through personally?
Ironically, and it's a question that I'm always asked, it never occurred. And in some ways, I think back to when I was bishop, that was 20 years ago, you know, 15 to 20 years ago. And it was obviously not as easy to talk to your priesthood leader back then about such things. It just coincidentally or whatever never occurred. In my experience, I would hope that I would have been kind and compassionate. I sense that I would have been. I feel like I was with others who had other issues that they brought forward as a way to, you know, try to help someone in their journey. But it just wasn't something that happened. Now, that's not to say that they weren't there, because they absolutely were there. I'm convinced that's the case. But no one was talking back then.
So did, after you came out in a testimony meeting, did your bishop let you go to the all-female relief society?
The control over what I was doing was really in the hands of our stake president. He took control of it. And although I think our bishop would have been supportive, our stake president wasn't. Many of the members of the ward were not supportive of such things either, which, again, I know many transgender individuals who showed up in their new units and maybe let their bishop know or not know, you know, who they really were, but are happily allowed to attend their third hour meeting. But I was not, and that was just something that wasn't going to occur.
But you kept going to church, and yet you were excommunicated. How did that happen?
I kept attending church because I loved the church, and I loved finding other people. I became more sensitized to people that were kind of on the fringe and marginalized. I found myself much more comfortable. Although I had been the gospel doctrine teacher in the ward at the time that I came out, I found myself much more comfortable in the gospel principles class with investigators and folks that were trying to find their way, and found great opportunities for service over the past year. The complications that brought along my church disciplinary council, it's really hard to describe how ambiguous and vague that feels to me. You know, if I didn't actually have lived through it, I would look back and say it must have been a dream, because it just kind of doesn't make sense to me. Ultimately, the phrase that I found myself turning at the Affirmation Conference a couple weeks ago when I spoke in the devotional was that I was excommunicated for the audacity of authenticity. I just don't know how else to explain that there's no written law, rule, policy that I broke, and yet I'm outside the faith. Apparently because I made people uncomfortable and because I had once served in a prominent position. And it's not a lot more complicated than that.
How'd you feel when you were excommunicated? That has to be a bit of a surprise. Like you said, you didn't break any laws or rules, but all of a sudden you get excommunicated.
I saw it coming, you know, in the interviews that led up to it. I was really in the process of grieving and preparing for it a couple months before it actually happened. I've learned a lot about how to process grief, and I experienced a lot of those feelings with regard to the likelihood of being put out of the church. I had hoped that by telling my story with some level of emotion and sincerity that that might not have had to happen. I don't think it was necessary that it occurred the way that it did. It, quite frankly, has left me with a diminished sense of loyalty to the organization, the institutional organization, not the gospel, as we understand it. It's difficult to be excluded from one's tribe, if you will. I've discovered that as difficult as it was to attend as a female church member, it's even more difficult to attend as a female excommunicated former member. For whatever reason, Latter-day Saints seem to not know how to deal with the excommunicant. And so they turn away, they shun, inadvertently perhaps, but the sense of loss of community and fellowship is more powerful and real than I ever imagined that it could be. And it's not that I've withdrawn from the church. I feel it's withdrawn from me.
Would you like to be rebaptized?
Certainly, but I am assertive in the fact that the only way I'll accept that ordinance is in my true and legal name, according to my true gender. I don't think that's going to happen in the near term, but I hold out hope, but that there's no reason for me to accept the ordinance in any other way.
I'm not sure you can say, but quite often they'll spell out, this is what needs to happen to re-enter the church. Did they do that with you?
It's very vague and difficult to comprehend what was said. I was very interested to read that letter. That letter was, it's going to be very difficult for the next leader that picks that letter up and says, okay, what do you need to do? I don't know. I mean, it's not that I won't say, it's that I really can't say because I don't know what it says. It's not clear.
So how did your former colleagues, you worked for decades at the LDS Church in the Architectural Temple Building Department.
Right.
How have they responded to you?
I have a few colleagues that have remained in touch and close. We went to lunch, a few of us together, just recently. Those that I think that were perhaps my closest friends in work situations have remained or have shown themselves to be friends despite the changes. And there are just many who have had no contact with me.
You helped design the new missionary training center.
That's correct.
And when you went there, in your authentic self?
I was invited by several of those who were the priesthood leaders over the missionary training center at the time that the design took place, and was invited on a personal tour along with a few of my colleagues to go through the facility. Unfortunately, I had to leave church employment about 9 months before the project was finished. I would have loved to have seen it through, but this was going to be my first chance in 9 months to see how it had turned out. And at that point, I had already been excommunicated, and those who invited me, I said, this is what's happened to me, and I will be, you know, dressing as a female in my Sunday best to come to the MTC. Is that going to be okay? Absolutely, it was going to be okay. And it was a wonderful balance. It was the same week as the disciplinary council. It was a wonderful balance to the exclusion on one evening, and then 48 hours later, the acceptance in that lovely setting by these others who I had great love and respect for. And it was just wonderful to be introduced to the young missionaries that, you know, that this is the group that designed this facility, including obviously this sister who is a part of that group. That was just very beautiful. And to me, exemplar of how things can be and should be.
So where else can we see your handiwork in temple designs? What are some other projects you've worked on?
I was the director of temple construction starting in 2003 through 2010, and that meant I had oversight of all of the temple construction worldwide. And then in 2007 became the director of temple design as well and held that position through 2013. And so temples that I had direct influence over were being dedicated, you know, through that 10-year period and continue to, you know, be completed even as of today. There aren't many that I worked on that are still left in construction, but Rome, for example, is one of them. It's been amazing to watch the continual dedication of temples that I was close to in one way or another continue to be added to the inventory.
Mm-hmm. I know we were talking actually before about, and Peggy's story noted that you were involved in the Provo City Center Temple, the restoration of that old tabernacle that mm-hmm. burned famously and then was restored and, I guess, elevated to temple status, which is a beautiful addition to downtown and keeping that.
It's the most remarkable project that I had a chance to work on. My architectural training in upstate New York was all about adaptive reuse and historic preservation of 19th century buildings, of the fabric of which is all over upstate New York. And so to be able, professionally, to be able to take on this iconic 19th century building and preserve it as opposed to restore it and adapt it to a use that's both higher and more spiritually profound, and to do it in such a wonderful and successful way was just a crowning achievement. We had, several years prior to that, had a very successful experience preserving and repurposing in some ways the Salt Lake Tabernacle. And when the fire occurred, it became clear that we wanted the same team together as much as humanly possible to work on the Provo Tabernacle that then ultimately became the City Center Temple. That team accomplished an amazing project.
So, Lori, what are you doing professionally?
I had hoped upon leaving the church office building that I could continue in the design and construction field. I found trying to accomplish that here in Utah was challenging. Architecture is a very male-dominated field in and of itself, and to kind of show up out of somewhere, nowhere, as a female architect with lots of experience just didn't seem to go well. I don't know. It just, to me, it felt like around the first of the year that I was generally blacklisted, whether inadvertently or directly, from being able to practice. So I quickly started using some peripheral skills and started a business consulting and professional coaching business. Have a little office just on South Main Street in South Salt Lake, and have had some wonderful experiences helping small businesses get started. And then later this summer, I found potential clients and some connections who would accept me as I am. And so I've opened my architectural practice on my own. I've never worked as a sole practitioner. And it takes a lot of courage to step out and do that and to take that risk. But I'm looking forward to being able to practice as my authentic self, the craft that I love so much.
So you've been pretty public in the last few months. How's your family dealing with all of this? How do you feel? Are you happy now that you're able to be yourself?
There's a lot of questions in that question. I'm extraordinarily happy and at peace in every part of my life as a result of living authentically, living true to myself. I never really wanted to be that transgender architect or that transgender stake president. To me, I just never really wanted to have those labels put together that way. But I've recognized that because of my past experiences and my current walk, that gives me an opportunity to have voice, and I'm passionate about the opportunity to use that voice in this moment of time to advocate and to support and to reach out. And the feedback that I've continued to get almost on a daily basis from people that haven't known me that reach out and say, I heard your story, I read your article in the Tribune, I just want you to know how much this has meant to me. And oftentimes, it's like this morning, I got a message from a mom who has a teenage male-to-female transgender daughter, and she needed some support and help, and I'd never talked with her before, and we exchanged some thoughts, and I think it helped. And, you know, to be able to do that, it brings me great joy. And I recognize that doing so is my gift to give to others. And I give that in love, even though it, you know, requires sometimes to step outside of the comfort zone. But I want to give that gift as frequently and as often as I can and to watch it evolve. I've told folks that I would not have chosen this path that I'm on. Particularly with how it's worked out with regard to my church membership. But while I walk this path, I'll find those along the way who are also walking it, and I'll walk with them. And I will, as often as anyone wants to listen, I will report my experiences along the way. It's not to answer your other question, Peggy, it's not easy for my family to have me be public. And that's why I'm very careful with their personal stories and to allow them the anonymity that they look for so that they can live their lives. But I have a responsibility, I believe, in my situation to use the voice I've been given.
Well, we wish you the best in the further steps on your journey, and thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And Peggy, thanks for your story. You can still read that at sltrib.com. And we encourage you to look at sltrib.com for all things Mormon that you can read about, and we'll catch you next time on Mormonland.